Welcome back. I did not even know that Barbara Monnier, when I first met her, was a budding and or secret or and or closeted novelist. But I had her on. I discovered that when I read Pushing the River, her third book. I now have in my hands and in my head still, Barbara, you'll be glad to know, I think, her latest,
very glad.
Your latest novel called Rocky Orchard. This is a very, very ambitious book, and one that, as I'm telling you, is in my head and won't leave. It will not leave. Barbara, remember, take me back to your days in theater, working for the legendary Great Remains Theater, and how we first met. What were you doing for Remains? I don't remember.
Well, I was actually their first paid employee, them, as you know, being an ensemble theater company, much like Steppenwolf has been. And I was the first person they put on the payroll, which meant I sort of did a little bit of
everything,
this, a little bit of that. Yes.
Well, that those were in the days.
Back in the day. And I think my real role with them was I hope I had a role in just keeping them alive until they could find their own theater space.
Well, you did it. It was one of the great sort of nomadic theater companies in the history of this town. It was sort of founded by, among others, Billy Peterson, who went on to be quite successful on TV, Amy Morton, who has been quite successful as a member of Steppenwolf, Donnie Moffat, Will Zarn. There were just a number of people. How did you come to that in Chicago, Barbara, before we get into your writing?
You know, strangely enough, when I moved here, I had one contact and one contact only, and that was a person who was working for Moming, which was a performance center,
sure,
largely for dance, performance art, gallery space. And it turned out that the one contact I had was leaving Moming, and I walked right into his job.
Wow.
And worked for them for 4 years. The Remains people were looking for an office space where they could just meet and brainstorm and have an address. So I got to know them that way. And there was a mutual, definitely liking and strong artistic connection and personal connections I made, and they ended up trying to figure out a way to hire me.
Well, you got
so I went from downstairs at Moming to upstairs at Remains and was with them for 4 years.
You were a great gang of people, I'll tell you that. You really were. At that time, what kind of, I know you studied writing at Yale and had some, you know, sort of prize-winning success. Were you writing fiction at the time?
I was. I was also interested in writing plays and screenplays. I was particularly interested in writing for the screen, and without going into too much detail about this, let's just say, like so many other people, when I finished school, I moved to Hollywood and found that loving films as much as I did and working in the film industry were two entirely different things.
You can love movies, and then you realize and get to Hollywood and realize the sorts of people who wind up making movies. Now, I'm not talking about the actors. I'm talking about the studios and that kind of scene.
Right.
It's driven a lot of people,
yes,
to suicide, I think.
Yeah, well, they were not my people.
Yeah, they're nobody's kind of people, Barbara Monnier. They're their own breed. I don't even want to get into how Hollywood and all that's going to change. When did you get serious about abandoning, when leaving Hollywood would make you say, well, maybe I'll try another kind of writing? Was it that simple? Because writing a novel, ladies and gentlemen, is one of the most, I'm sure you think, well, these people just, Stephen King just sits down at a desk and the words just flow out. It's daunting. It's challenging and daunting and can be terribly frustrating. When did you switch from screenplay to say to yourself, well, maybe I can write a novel? Because that's a big leap, Barbara.
It's a huge leap, and especially since I really started out, and what I largely studied was poetry. And I assure you, with no false modesty whatsoever, I was a terribly bad poet. But it gave me what I still have, which is a tremendous love of being able to tell something in an economy of words and beautifully put together words. That's kind of my thing. That's really what I strive for. So it was an expansion to move from poetry to writing plays and screenplays, because then, you know, you got dialogue in there, you got some more words, you got a little expansion. As you're saying, Rick, it's a huge leap to writing a novel.
Yeah.
And the first one that I wrote way back when, I originally wrote it as a memoir.
Huh.
So
was that a little birdie told me? Or you in the green shirt?
You in your green shirt, which started out as a memoir, so I sort of came in the back door writing a true story that was partly a story of a segment of my mother's history and a segment of my own history that I was trying to parallel. And I had a lot of found material, which translates into a lot of pages that have already been written for you in the form of letters that my mother had.
Mm-hmm.
And went through years of working on that book. And along the line, somebody that I hired said, you know, I really think you should stick with one of these stories, forget about what happened in real life, and just let yourself go with it, turn it into a novel.
Wow.
So I did that. I took one of the stories, I did exactly that. And as I said, I sort of backdoored it, meaning I started out not having, if I'd have sat down with a blank piece of paper and thought I was going to write a novel, I'm not sure I ever would have been able to do it.
That's a very honest assessment of that, and I think that very enlightening, too, about your work. There's a real economy of the latest novel, The Rocky Orchard, which was a stunner, is about 172 pages long, and it is written lyrically. I mean, I'd say I would have guessed that you had dealt with poetry, but you have a quote at the beginning: the distinction between the past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion. And you work basically two main characters in the book. I'm going to have you. I want to talk a little bit more about your career, but after the commercial break, I want you to describe this, because there's some things I don't want to give away. Do you know what I mean, Barbara?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to
misspeak. Sure do.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to have you do it so it can remain kind of mystery, because you know me well enough to say, well, and then this happens, and this happens, and this happens, and that's like total spoiler alert. What was it like when you saw a copy of your first novel?
As much as you know it's coming and you've worked for so many hours and weeks and years, it is still an unbelievable thrill to hold it in your hands and to just know that there's a sort of a material representation, if you will, of all of that thought, I would say, more than anything else, so much thought and work and reworking and then reworking again, and you end up being able to hold this thing in your hands that other people can read the end result of. It's really an amazing feeling. It's the reason to go through all of the stuff that, sadly to say, never gets any easier. Each time you write, it's every bit as daunting and challenging.
But it must be.
The rules are the same.
But it must be on some level, even a level that you forget days later. It must kind of be empowering, Barbara, or no? It must.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about that.
I mean, for me, what's empowering is you start out with an idea of what you want to say. And it's more abstract than it sounds. I mean, it sounds like you have, you know, a very clear notion and
you
just sit down and you write it.
Yeah, of course.
It's like, you know, a picture you want to paint.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And visual artists will tell you that what ends up on the canvas or whatever material they're using is usually very different than what they conceived of. But you're trying to get the idea right in a way that really nails it. And when I feel like I've done that, it's like, yes, that's what I wanted to say. That
yeah, did it. Yeah, that must be a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
It is. It is.
What about, I do want to devote half the show to this, your latest and fourth novel. What about we talked about how idiotic the people who run Hollywood can be. But the publishing business, as you have started to get into it, has been, you know, earthquake central. How easy was it to get your books? How easy have you found the publishing game? You're now published by Amica Press, and I know a lot of the people from there, and I think that's a wonderful, wonderful imprint. But how did you find that? Because it can be discouraging.
I put up a post on Facebook saying that I had neared what I thought was the end until I met my editor. But at that point, I thought I was nearing the end of writing Pushing the River. And I put it out on Facebook saying, here's where I am. What are people's experiences right now with self-publishing versus trying to get an agent versus small presses? And somebody wrote back to me and said, why don't you get in touch with my small press? They're Chicago area based. I've had a really good experience with them. And I did. And you will not believe this when I tell you this, Rick. You'll know. I heard back from them probably less than 48 hours later.
You're kidding.
On a Sunday.
Your lucky day. Your lucky day. That's amazing.
Yes. And I will tell you, my experience with them has been phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. My editor, John Menos, has been so above and beyond. One of the other publishing partners, who's their production and design person, also has made herself available to read anything and everything I send her.
Oh.
Sarah is terrific. The downside, which you might know, is they have absolutely no budget for
promotion.
Marketing.
That's one of the things in this precarious, you know, pandemic age, is the whole notion of how one goes about promoting and selling a book. Because as you've learned after four novels, a huge portion, you would think to yourself, wouldn't you, Barbara, oh man, I wrote it, you sell it. Self-marketing is one of the big, big tools. Now, I don't know how any writer does, Stephen King does without it, and James Patterson does without it, but there aren't many. We're going to take a break, but before that, I want to tell you what a couple of previous guests of mine on this show, people I respect and admire, have said about Barbara's The Rocky Orchard, her fourth and latest novel. Actually, three of the five jacket quotes you have are people I've interviewed and people I admire. Rita Dragonette, whose latest book was the 14th of September, says, a novel you'll want to reread the minute you finish. That's pretty good. James Peterson, a very interesting writer, calls it luminous. The Rocky Orchard is a moment that contains all the moments of life, the fullness of being. That's pretty good. I have already said that I love it, and now Barbara, after a commercial break, will explain to you, trying to keep its lovely lyrical secrets, what it's all about. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We have detailed the so far fascinating career of Barbara Monnier. What do you do for a living, Barbara, if you can say because you are not James Patterson and you are not Stephen King, can you say what you do to pay your rent?
Well, I could say, Rick, but then, you know, no, I can't, of course. I actually took a little bit, less than you would think, of a left turn from my days working directly in the arts. And for the last, 32 years, I guess, I've been a clinical social worker in private practice of therapy.
Oh, wow. Here in Chicago, right?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
So I do that about...
Wait a minute. I've known you for more than 30 years? Oh, my God. And another mutual...
No, actually, Rick, 40 years.
Oh, good.
Go on.
Good. And another mutual friend of ours has made her career as the world's greatest dog trainer. Life takes wonderfully funny turns. And there are a number of turns in the Rocky Orchard. I'm going to ask you, Barbara, there are two main characters, a woman named Maisie, who has returned to a sort of family summer home farm, and an elderly woman who she meets. Will you elaborate, please? You know why I'm doing this, don't you? I can't.
Yeah, okay. Yes, I do.
Good.
I will tell you that my editor and I struggled mightily for how to write a description of this book, even to put on the back cover, without giving too much away. But I will say this. Yes, Rick's done a good sort of beginning description.
The good
and
Cliff Notes version,
It really sort of becomes increasingly unclear exactly why this young woman named Maisie has returned. This farm has been a pivotal place in her life at various junctures, and she just sort of shows up there at the beginning of the book, and it becomes more and more unclear exactly why she's there, and it becomes more and more unclear exactly what's going on.
Right.
And the book was written, I hope, very carefully so that you can interpret it different ways.
No question.
And I wanted that to be the case. I mean, I would consider it, in addition to being a novel and a work of fiction, it's sort of a, if you will, a meditation on life and on how any of us think about and understand our own lives and how we think about what's meaningful and important and what we remember.
And also what's real and what we can trust. I think I may be going off base here, but what we can trust.
No,
about
not
our,
at all.
What we can trust about our own past and how what's true. What's true and what's real? That's there are big distinctions between those two things, and I'm not talking about the era of fake news or anything. Lula, the other woman, is a fascinating character in spending so much time with Maisie and Lula. Does your knowledge of them, of course, it deepens. But when you first conceive of these people, how well do you know them as a writer?
When I first conceived of them, not well at all.
Yeah, right.
They really grew and developed within me, just as I hope they do in the book. But when I first conceived of this book, I knew that Maisie was a young woman. And I had a basic idea of why she had returned to this place. And that's about all I knew about her.
Mm.
And I knew Maisie was an older woman. And I, even the picture, the visual I had in my mind about how Lula looked changed over time. Mm. Originally, I sort of had an older Jessica Tandy pictured, and then I had a very, very different visual picture. So it was kind of, it's a good question because my whole conception of them really took shape pretty gradually.
As you wrote.
Yes.
And I'm assuming that in the writing of this, then there were any number of surprises for you as a writer as these characters started to take shape where you said, oh my goodness, that's the way she feels. Is that how it works? Having finished a novel, never written a novel, I have the feeling that there are a number of surprises as the character starts to form in your mind.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Both in terms of events and events that showed the character. For instance, I don't think this will give too much away.
Okay.
There's a scene in which Lula, who's, you know, really an elderly woman, probably in her late 70s, early 80s. And she and Maisie, who's about 26, are picking blueberries. And Maisie swears that blueberries are hitting her on the cheek. And, you know, this older woman acts like, well, they can't just fly. Anyway, it turns out that Lula is secretly tossing them at her, jokingly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I remember that. I remember that section.
A kind of almost childlike, cranky humor that that just came to me. And I thought, yeah, that's what Lula's going to do. To be playful and to sort of break the tension. And that surprised me. But, yep, that's what was going to happen.
Well, there is. I'm going to just read a. I'm going to flip to a page and just read a paragraph or two because I want people. You are a very, very stylish writer. Beginning of chapter six, it is the first and last family trip. Days and days of endless barren landscapes, our spanking new station wagon throwing up a dust storm that followed in our wake. No air conditioning. The windows were wide open, making any kind of talk sort of impossible. It was dry and dusty, with a hot wind blowing in our faces all day long. My brother and I bounced and blew around in the back seat in a woozy stupor. Every so often, one of us would come out of our haze long enough to let out a plaintive whine of, "How much longer?" Or, even more important, "Are you sure there's a pool?" I was pretty sure my parents were tricksters, I say to Lula. I'm surprised to find myself saying this. It's a big thing to confess. What a weird and suspicious little kid I was. But it's true. From an early age, I was watching them out of the corners of my eyes. Lula says, "Maybe you just notice things." That's lovely writing, Barbara Monnier. That's really lovely writing. And these two women do share all manner of stories. The reception of the book, you must be quite pleased, yes?
I am.
Not just for me, of course, Barbara, because I've known you for 40 years. I love everything you do. But, you know, and one of the things, too, about this current, you know, publishing book scene is, you know, maybe I'm wrong. There are certainly fewer newspaper book sections, but perhaps there are more online book review things and you can get public feedback. Do you find that, or is it tough out there?
Say it's pretty tough.
Yeah.
You know, I think the reception to this is critically, it's been wonderful.
Yeah, I'll bet.
It does seem, you know, my feeling is that I feel like I'm standing on a rooftop just throwing out copies of the book without any sense.
Turning them into like paper airplanes, yeah.
Exactly. Who's picking them up and what their responses are going to be. That part of it is really missing.
Yeah.
The kinds of conversations where you get a feeling for what your book is evoking in people and what it's making them think, that you do in the kinds of face-to-face readings and events that you usually have around a book launch.
Well, you write
in
the acknowledgments of a lovely paragraph, too. "I know that my children will eventually read this book. I know that they will love it beyond reason, even if they don't happen to like it. I anticipate that they will be mighty pleased to find that their mother has written a work of fiction where not one character, nor one event, nor anything whatsoever seems strangely familiar." That's a great, that's just a lovely paragraph. Barbara Monnier, why don't you have a website? Every author, I don't have one either, but every author...
I do.
What is it? Oh, here it is. It's Barbara Monnier author, right?
That's right, yes.
Okay.
And there are samples of all of my books and...
ways in which to buy them?
Ways in which to buy them. You can read chapters of them and get a peek at what they're all about. There's all kinds of stuff on there.
Yeah, this makes me feel like a total idiot because I'm looking on the back of the book saying, Where's the website? And then I realized I looked at it yesterday and I put it in this thing. It is Barbara, I'm going to spell it for you, ladies and gentlemen. BarbaraMonnierAuthor.com. Barbara Monnier com. I don't think she puts in anywhere on her website. I did look at it fairly closely about our knowing each other for 40 years. And, you know, we knew the young Bill Peterson. That's all we know. Barbara, it's an ongoing pleasure to read your work. This one is really spectacular.
Thank you so much, Rick. That means a lot.
Well,
thanks for having me on the show.
Your writing means a lot to me too, hon. Let me know if you've got any, you know, no one's doing book signings or anything, but let me know if you've got anything coming up where the public can see you and meet you, okay? That would probably be on your website. That would be BarbaraMonierAuthor.com. Duh. Thanks a million. Thanks for taking some of your afternoon off to see me. Thanks, Barb.
My pleasure, Rick. Bye-bye.
Bye.